As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Yo. Technology. What is it all about?
You take a sample from a cow, about equivalent to one of my fingernails, so 2.5 milliliters. The cow doesn't feel anything. It goes back to whatever the cow was doing before. So theoretically, that little sample in 40 days can produce the equivalent of 7 or 8 cows worth of beef, about 3,000 kilograms, or in American terms, about 7,000 pounds. Whereas the cows themselves would take 28 months in a feedlot to grow to the point where they could be slaughtered to produce the meat.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. You know, last week, I promised that I'd be doing more stuff on this whole cultured meat phenomenon. And so here we are. This week, we have none other than Jim Mellon, who is the billionaire Scottish investor who is, by some distance, the single biggest investor in the world in this sector. He's backed a whole bunch of companies. He just raised nearly $100 million through his investment vehicle, Agronomics, to really double down on his investments. And I just wanted to talk to him about the why. Like, what does he see that is so compelling that as a canny investor, he has decided that now is the time to just bet a whole boatload of money on this brand new industry of factory-made fish, beef, pork, poultry, etc. And anyhow, I think you'll just find his insights and his conviction about why this will be the way that we produce and eat meat in the not-too-distant future really intriguing. And I'd love to hear about what you guys think of what he is saying, as well as from last week's guest, Mark Cotter at BitBio. But it's clear that something is happening here. You know, 5 years ago, there was one lab-grown meat company. Now there are more than 70, and they're more and more cropping up all over the world. You know, there is momentum building here. And it's going to be just be really interesting to see how all of this plays out. So that's it. Here's my conversation with Jim Mellon, one of the people right at the heart of this movement. Enjoy. I'm just fascinated by kind of, let's call it lab-grown meat, cultured meat, cultivated meat, whatever you want to call it. And I came across Agronomics and what you very cleverly called Moo's Law, which I enjoyed. But what is your interest and what is the vision? Like, what's your thesis here? Because it does feel like the way I kind of view it is that we're at this kind of Tesla Roadster moment, in that we've got this new technology, it's been proven, but it's still kind of expensive, niche, not scale, and now it's about getting to the kind of Model 3 or much cheaper, you know, kind of mass adoption and scale up. But I don't know if you agree with that kind of comparison.
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. But as yet, the companies that we've invested in don't have Tesla prices. So there's still upside to be had on a considerable basis. And of course, I think the total addressable market for what these companies are doing is even bigger than the EV market. You know, we calculated at $5 trillion. So it's not just about food. It's about materials as well. It's about the picks and shovels that go into making Moo's Law happen. So the origin of this is that I've been in biotech for quite a while with my partners. We've created a number of biotech companies, and really the process by which this, at least the initial foods and materials are made, is a biotech process. And so it was a natural thing for us to get involved in. And Agronomics, as of yesterday, raised just short of another $100 million, which it expects to invest in the next 9 months. So as the companies scale up, they require, as you know better than anyone, yeah, more and more money. And they so they're at the stage now where most of them are doing A's, and some of them are doing, well, a few of them will do B's, and maybe even some of them might list, possibly via SPACs in the US. So whereas up till the end of last year, you know, not much more than $1.5 billion had gone into the sector, we would expect this year to be at least another $2 billion coming in. And it's a bit like being an admiral in the Swiss Navy, Danny. At the moment, we're the largest in the world. And we're partly helped by the fact that there's nothing else that people can invest in. And also that, as you know, a lot of the investors in this field are purely philanthropic. So people like, you know, Chuck Lowy or Jeremy Collar, and they're doing it because they want to reduce intensive farming to reduce animal cruelty, which is something that I share with them. But we're kind of quasi-philanthropic and quasi-commercial. So by the time we invest this money, we'll be, you know, $250 million in it. Plus we've got another pot of money coming from largely the Middle East, which will be another $300 million. So, you know, we'll be able to lead some rounds and to invest in some new things. But I think there's four big opportunities here, if I can just summarize it for you. One is investing in these companies. Two is creating, as we've done in our biotech business, white space companies, using licenses from research institutions and finding opportunities that haven't yet been addressed. And we're hoping to do one of those quite soon. And then there's the licensing business, where you take a company from the West Coast of America, for instance, which doesn't have any idea about how to go internationally, and team them up with a strategic partner, let's say in the Middle East, where 95% of the food is imported. Mm. The partner provides the money to build the factory to produce the proteins, and the company provides the technology, and somewhere in between are pots of money work. And then the last one is carbon credits, because these alternative protein companies have not yet exploited the opportunity they have to sell carbon credits.
No.
But we know that all the conventional food producers are going to be taxed on their carbon emissions, which are high.
How do we know that? Is that in train, or is that just kind of logical, just given how intensive?
No, it's in train. But, you know, all these companies have been scrambling just to get a product, to raise money, to, you know, they can't do everything at once. And but it's something that we want to help with. And it gives them a price umbrella in the early days when they're, as you rightly point out, they're Tesla Roadsters, and, you know, they're dial-up stage of the internet, really, and they're not very commercially viable.
So you're investing all of this money, but again, just going back to the analogy of Tesla, they nearly went bankrupt every year after the Roadster for about a decade before they kind of made it to the promised land, which is a very, very recent phenomenon. Are you sure that you're not too early here? And do you see the path to this becoming a gigantic industry? Is there anything that you're like, well, we still have to crack X?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because one of the reasons why we have relatively many investments is because, as I said in my book, I think that some of these companies will be sold. And the reason that we're attracted to cell ag in particular relative to plant-based is it's typically got a stronger IP moat than the plant-based stuff. Some of them will fold. It's the nature of the game. And some, not many of them, will be bold. Maybe Upside, Just, Blue Nalu, a couple of others, and go public. So, yeah, there will be, unfortunately, there'll be, failures. The ones that will be bought, I think, will be bought for their technology by the big food companies, which largely agnostic to what they sell, as long as it's legal and the consumers buy it. And there are already, you know, some investments by the big food companies and some of these companies. Your point is correct. While all the companies have products, they all have something that you can eat or taste or feel.
Yeah.
None of them are at great scale yet. And that's going to be the big challenge. But we look at that really, really closely to see what their path is to reducing the cost of the media, getting the price of the growth factors down, scaling up in terms of bioreactors, making them cheaper. And some of them are going to do it. I mean, I've got no doubt about that. So I'll tell you, in my opinion, the dairy industry as it is today will be gone within 10 years. I mean, you can see it all around you in California, especially plant-based milks. But then the precision fermentation is an established product, even if it's not at scale. And I see no reason why we'd ever be drinking milk or eating cheese or eating yogurts that have cows associated with them, because it's just going to be so much better. So that's one industry that you can tick off. The seafood industry is under a lot of pressure, not least because of the recent documentary. And there are very few environmental positives about seafood, as indeed there are almost no human health positives, given the mercury, toxins, antibiotics, et cetera, et cetera. And Blue Nalu will be producing a few hundred kilos for sale in the US a week by the end of this year, which is quite remarkable, and has engaged with regulators from an early stage, has raised enough money to do it, and has a very, very good business plan. And seafood, I think, is much more consumer accepting because people are aware of the problems with seafood. And their first product will be Mahi Mahi, which you'll be able to try or buy at the end of this year.
Wow.
And leather, of course, you don't eat it, so it's already on the market.
Right. And is the vision to replace industries? Because, you know, you talk to some of the CEOs and there's kind of a dance, it feels like they have to do, where it's like, well, you know, in other words, they don't want to piss off the powers that be. And some of them have big meat or big fish investors. So I haven't come across one yet who said, yeah, we want to replace the beef industry or the pork industry or whatever it may be. But you, as an investor, how do you see it? How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, well, you know, Dean and Borden have gone bust in the US because of, I think, largely the encroachment of the plant-based milks in the last 10 years. There's a sort of tipping point of economic viability.
Dean and
Borden. B-O-R-D-E-R-N. They're two biggest dairy producers in the US. And I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it's estimated to be around a fifth of the US market is now plant-based. And that's up from, what, 0.5% or 1% 10 years ago. So the trajectory is pretty clear. So that's why I make the assertion about dairy. In terms of, you know, replacing the whole industry, I mean, a lot of people will say, well, what about the artisanal farmers of beef? And what about the ones who treat their animals well? The reality is there aren't very many of them. In the US, farming of animals is 99% intensive. And, you know, the fact is chickens are three times as big as they were in 1950. They're completely distended. They live brutal short lives, 23 days. What's good about that? There's nothing to applaud about that industry. And the same goes for swine and or hogs, as you call them, and cattle in the US. They have miserable and really bad lives. So that if we did replace those industries, the intensive farming industries, I wouldn't be shedding any tears for them.
Mm. But do you think that'll happen? I mean, I'm not saying the beef industry, the meatpacking industry will go away, but that, you know, looking at dairy as an example, they could get to, I don't know, half the market, for example.
I think in dairy, you know, artisanal or cheese manufacturers will probably want regular dairy, and that will keep some part of the market alive. But the bulk of the liquid market will be gone within 10 years. In meat, I think the London-based institute that came up with that report, which says 50% will be plant-based or cell ag-based by 2030, maybe a little bit optimistic, but it's on the general right path, so about half the market. And in fish, I think the figure could be higher just because of the consumer backlash against both farmed fish and wild-caught fish is impressive. And the product is identical without any waste, without any toxins, mercury, et cetera, to the best of species. So And, you know, a company like Blue Nalu is now producing or expects to be selling its product at only twice the price of the mahi-mahi that you buy in the US now. So it's not very far for it to fall back down to griddle parity, basically.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm very optimistic about it. I just don't know what the exact trajectory will be. But, you know, when I started my career in the mid-1980s in US tech, no one had any idea what it was going to become. And no one knew who the winners were going to be. But the winners there are, and then, you know, they're all around you in San Francisco. I think that obviously the winners in this industry will be completely geographically dispersed. I don't think there'll be one sort of food valley anywhere that produces all the innovation. And already you're beginning to see that happening around the world.
But the scale of the opportunity is as big or bigger.
I don't think it's as big as the whole of the tech industry.
Yeah.
But it's certainly as big as the electric vehicle industry. And because of the IP protection that these companies have developed in the last 3 or 4 years, it could be more profitable in individual companies that, you know, because although Tesla is a great company, it's going to suffer from the fact that the Germans, the Land Rovers, the every other company in the world that makes cars is going to be producing electric vehicles as well. So the competition is going to be enormous. I don't think the same will apply in certain categories of the food or materials industry. But I can't say which is going to be the biggest winner. We can only guess at them. But at the moment, these companies don't have particularly high prices. They haven't suffered from their sort of frenzy because none of them are public. They're not available to the public. And institutional investors can't work out what category they fit in. If you're an agri investor, maybe that's an area you might look at, but it wouldn't be your full time. And if you're a biotech investor, it probably doesn't fit into your normal remit for investing. So it's a difficult one for investors to get hold of. But yeah, you asked me, is it going to happen? Yeah, I think 10 to 20 years, most of the stuff that we're talking about will be produced in an industrial way on a very small fraction of the land with very small water usage relatively to the current production, and obviously with a much lower emission level, even though some people dispute that. I think that that is a clear-cut case that about a fifth of emissions come from intensively farmed animals. And the energy intensity of this stuff is much, much lower.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And you talked about the carbon credit side of things, well, only because I cover this stuff in some way, shape, or form, and used to cover energy. But when I buy beef, ground beef at the store, I do think, like, I wonder what the carbon footprint of this beef, this kind of pound of ground chuck, is. But you said that it is in train that carbon costs will start to be factored in. Can you just talk about, like, how and when that's going to happen? Because I feel like that is significant.
Yeah, well, as you know, this year is COP26 here in the UK, actually, in Glasgow, my dad's hometown. And I think there'll be much of the world, there'll be generally applied carbon taxes. I mean, there are some carbon taxes already that are levied, but particularly on things like cement, fertilizers, you know, very energy and steel producers, very energy intensive businesses, and they have to buy carbon credits to offset their pollution. And those carbon credits are typically bought from people who are planting trees in the Amazon or you know, Tesla, as an example, has made, as you well know, all of its money in recent quarterly earnings from selling carbon credits to, I can't even remember the name of it now, but some sort of funny name that the PSA Chrysler consortium calls itself now. But it's only now that the food producers are coming under the glare of the spotlight. And by the end of this year, I'm pretty sure there will be in Europe at least carbon credits on conventional food producers. And obviously the alternative producers should be claiming the carbon credit. So somehow or other, we want to get in the middle of that for the benefit of our fund shareholders, basically. And that's what we are doing. But as yet, it's a bit like everything else in this. It's pulling pieces together that will take some time. I think that's the last of our pieces to fall into place. But we know that we've got a licensing deal in the Middle East that's upcoming. And we know that we've got a white space opportunity that's upcoming as well. So those are two of the other boxes that are being ticked at the moment. And it's impressive.
And you said there's like $300 million in money from the Middle East. Is that going to be invested via agronomics and as you guys choose? Or what's the situation there?
Yeah, it's basically going to be pari passu with agronomics, but it's an unlisted structure because that's what they prefer.
Right.
And so everything that we invest in will be, what's the right way of putting it, prorated across the two pots of money. And it is what we choose. I mean, obviously, we're hopefully not reckless in what we choose, but, it'll be follow-on rounds of existing companies that we like. It'll be new companies that are coming along that tickle our interest. There'll be picks and shovels in the industry, which I think is a really interesting area to invest in. And then the licensing white space opportunities as well. So we are part investment company and part sort of operating company. My colleague who is on the ground sort of, you know, talking to all the companies on a daily basis has worked with me for 15 years, largely on the biotech side. So he's pretty familiar with it. And we've got a beefed up team, but
we can say that more
people. In agronomics, we don't charge a management fee, but we do have a performance fee. And then the other one, we charge a modest management fee because this is not a get rich scheme for us. I mean, I'm the biggest shelter of agronomics and I'm very happy with its performance. But for us, it's about trying to accelerate the process of needed change in the way that we eat around the world.
Are there any problems in terms of, especially when you're thinking about beef, the idea that you have to use fetal bovine serum as the kind of starter dough, so to speak, or is that no longer the case because now you can kind of create stem cells out of other cells?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the only company that we know of that's still using FBS, which in a way is completely antithetical to the values and goals, because you know the way that that's extracted, it's pretty awful, is Eat Just. But I know that they're trying to, you know, find an alternative. The growth factors are now synthetic growth factors. They're very expensive still, but we can see the prices coming down dramatically. And you mentioned the use of iPSC cells, induced pluripotent stem cells, which Meatable is using, which obviates the need for growth factors of the current type. But the iPSCs, which is why Dr. Cotter is so important, are unstable. They're difficult to handle, and he's found a way of doing that through his Cambridge-based company. So we are actually big fans of the Meatable thing. And theoretically, as I'm sure the good doctor told you, from one cow, they could feed the world forever without the need to go back taking stem cell samples from cows regularly. So we are very excited by what they're up to. But, you know, all these little sort of lights of technology that are shining sort of in different parts of the world, we know that they're incrementally leading to Moore's Law, price coming down, scale going up, taste, texture, convenience being the same for consumers, possibly the price being the same or even lower, and then mass adoption. And our major thrust is in ground beef, obviously, because it's 60% of the US market and it doesn't need careful structuring. And actually, people don't really mind if it's in a sausage or it's in a patty, what it looks like. So we're going after the low-hanging fruit. We're not really interested in the niche stuff like kangaroo meat or caviar or fur, which some companies are working on at the moment.
Right, right, right. So what does keep you up at night? What's the thing that could derail all of this? Or is the idea that there isn't?
Well, what happens if one of these foods gets onto the market and causes food poisoning or worse?
Yep.
I mean, I think that's the, you know, that is something that's a matter of great concern. But they're all regulated. They're all engaged with the regulators. All their stuff so far has been closely examined by regulators. And because they're not using GM, there should be an open pathway to commercialization. The second thing is that, you know, the biggest cost is the growth factors. And, you know, I know that Meatable's finding a way around them, but what happens if their way doesn't work because the iPSC cells are too unstable? And what happens if the growth factors just don't come down to the price of recombinant proteins developed by drug companies for very big diseases like diabetes? So insulin, for instance, is effectively a growth factor that is cheap and or is cheap to produce. We need to get it down to that price. So, and then there's the corporate execution risk. I mean, none of these companies existed until a few years ago. None of them have ever turned a profit. None of them have been, you know, gone through the whole of their business plan. And we don't know if they're going to be the right ones to take it forward. But I suppose that was the risk in technology in the early 80s and 90s, basically. And some of them have come through. We'll just have to navigate those waters. But, you know, I don't doubt that the industry will succeed. It's a question of who will succeed in it.
Yeah. And for the folks at home who aren't au fait with all this, what is a growth factor?
Basically, in a nutshell, just in principle,
yeah,
you take a sample from a cow about equivalent to one of my fingernails. Mm-hmm. So 2.5 milliliters. The cow doesn't feel anything. It goes back to whatever the cow was doing before. You extract from that sample what are called stem cells, which are the precursor cells to all forms of life. But these particular stem cells, you want to differentiate into the key components of meat. And those are muscle, principally, fat, and connective tissue. But ultimately, most of the companies will just use the muscle and fat.
Yeah.
You differentiate them into those through established biotech processes, and then you feed them. You amplify them by bathing them in nutrients, which are roughly equivalent to what the animal would be eating if it was being intensively farmed. So amino acids, starch, sugar, blah, blah, blah. But to make them amplify quickly, because otherwise you'd be sitting around forever, you introduce growth factors which encourage the amplification process, and the doubling process becomes faster. So theoretically, that little sample in 40 days can produce the equivalent of 7 or 8 cows worth of beef, about 3,000 kilograms, or in American terms, about 7,000 pounds. Whereas the cows themselves would take 28 months in a feedlot to grow to the point where they could be slaughtered to produce the meat. And of course, the meat that comes out of the lab doesn't have any contaminants, doesn't have any antibiotics, any hormones. There is no waste. There's no head. There's no tail. There's no
hooves,
leather or hide, all that sort of, no entrails, nothing like that. You just get the best of the bit that you want from the animal. So that's the exciting part of it. And all of these companies have produced prototype scale. So they can produce a few liters, a few kilograms of whatever they're talking about. Only Eat Just claims to be producing at a bigger scale, but I don't really know what their production figures are. You'll be able to ask them yourself when you talk to them this afternoon. So that in a nutshell is how the whole process works. And you can do it really for anything. So you can do it for collagen, which is currently derived from animals, which is a very big market, particularly in cosmetics and food. You can do it for threads. And so there's a company called Bolt Threads in the US. It's raised quite a lot of money. You can do it for cotton. And one of our companies, Geltor, is doing it for cotton, which is hugely damaging to the environment. So that's why I say the total addressable market is huge. And then there's subsectors. So I don't know, infant formula. There are companies working, there's one in the US called BioMilk, one in Singapore called Turtle Tree, trying to get cells to express or to become mammary cells, basically, to produce milk. And the infant formula market is enormous. It's between 50 and 60 billion US dollars a year. So that's why I say the total addressable size is very big. The margins could be better than conventional food because the input ratios are much lower than going into animals to produce meat at scale. And it's very, very disruptive. And it's happening quickly. I mean, this is exactly your area, Danny. I mean, the disruption of very old industries, basically.
And that, going back to that fingernail size sample, how is it that there are stem cells in there? Because the traditional kind of controversy around stem cells is you had to get stem cells from, well, in the case of cows, fetal bovine serum, you're like extracting blood from the fetus until it dies. That's obviously not great. How are you getting stem cells from just any old cow?
Well, the fetal bovine syndrome is a growth factor.
Mm.
And so the fetus, as the cow goes to slaughter, is giving up.
Yeah.
Pretty gruesome. It's growth factors that will allow that fetus to grow into a calf. It's different with stem cells. We all have stem cells everywhere in our body. Basically, when our cells die, we need to get new cells, and those stem cells act as repair mechanisms or progenitors for our whole regular and recurring development. There are also very early stem cells, embryonic stem cells, that are extracted from human fetuses effectively, or from the umbilical cord. But that's not what we're talking about here. We just need the stem cells that will become muscle or will become fat or connective tissue. That's all we need. We don't need, you know, the very early precursor stem cells.
Got you. Last question and I'll let you go. Labeling. There's been a big fight out here, you know, cattle ranchers, et cetera, saying, you know, initially to the plant-based guys, because the plant guys have stuff in the supermarkets and restaurants, saying you can't call this meat and it can't be in the meat aisle because it's not. And that kind of sniping goes back and forth, but at the moment that stuff is in the meat aisle. But how do you see this playing out? Are the tensions already there? Like, because it does feel the marketing and branding will be incredibly important here in getting people to be okay with this idea of, you know, eating stuff that was grown in a lab, not in an animal.
Absolutely right. I mean, the focus groups from all the companies and the industry associations like Good Food Institute suggest that consumers are ready to try, but who knows until it's actually out there. In terms of labeling, the Cattlemen's Associations of the US, which are not as well funded as the NRA, but are quite well funded, have been doing everything. They've been, you know, trying to get state legislation, federal legislation, and so far they haven't succeeded. In the case of seafood, there has been an agreement, an industry agreement, that the cell-based seafood will be called cell-cultured seafood, and the wild seafood will be called wild-caught seafood, and the farm stuff will be called farmed seafood. That's agreed, so there's a path forward there. In terms of the meat, I call them the agro-Luddites. I think that they can and will make it longer to market for some of these products. The nomenclature of the stuff, I just have no idea, but beyond that, Impossible have proven, and corn and meatless farms here in the UK have proven that you can get shelf space if your product is selling and the consumers want it. If you go into one of our supermarkets here, they're all over. I mean, it's, you know, I would say it's half the meat aisle now. So I'm not too worried about that. The industry associations in Europe are not nearly as strong. I don't see them in Asia at all. And the seafood industry doesn't really have a lobbying association of any power. There isn't any leather or materials industry association, I think, that can cause a fuss. So the number one is the US Meat Producers Associations. And without a doubt, they will be roadblocks to these companies. But ultimately, and I just want to point you to, I'm not, you know, the obvious analogy is the horse and cart people before the car came in the 1900s. But I think a better one in food is pasteurization. The whole US milk industry didn't want pasteurization, even though milk that was unpasteurized was killing lots and lots of people. The consumers demanded it. And lo and behold, it was mandated by the federal government in the US. And But people who are dying of milk-related incidents, very, very many of them, by the way, stopped dying because pasteurization was mandated. So consumers sometimes do lead the charge in changing food habits.
Right. Well, it's going to be an interesting 10 years.
Yeah. When I next come out to San Francisco, let's see if we can get hold of some of that cell culture stuff and eat it together.
That would be awesome. I'm actually, interestingly, next week, I think I'm going to have a tasting at Upside / Memphis Meats.
All right. Oh, that'd be great.
And that is all the time we have. I wanted to thank Jim for taking the time to chat. I want to thank you all for listening. And like I said, I'd love to hear what listeners think. If you want to drop me an email at danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk, or you can tweet at me at Danny Fortson. You know, just if you're in this universe, if you think it's what Jim is saying is sounds right, do you think it's not going to happen? If so, why not? I just think it's a fascinating world. And when you think about the potential implications, again, as we discussed last week, you know, they're pretty profound if this does actually come to pass. But obviously, there's much to figure out still and a lot of money to spend. Anyhow, hope you guys enjoyed it. I will be back next week with another show. So please do tune in. And thank you, as ever, for the ratings, for the reviews, for telling your friends about the show. And that's it. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.